the streets are screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, I want to talk about a number of topics here today. Primarily, U.S. government debt as the central topic. But before that, just a comment on the global oil price deflation situation. We talked about that several months ago. I think it was late December when the global oil, crude oil prices were plummeting, if you remember, as it was occurring in the midst of the stock market and other financial asset market deflation going on. Everything, all those asset deflation trends sort of leveled out here in January, in February. Attributed largely to the Federal Reserve, stopping its rise in interest rates, reversing itself virtually overnight. We'll talk about that a little bit more. In just a short 2 months, after predicting another rate hike in December and four more in 2019 and then three more in 2020, all of a sudden the Fed stops in its tracks. Okay, why did it do that? Was it because Trump was bad-mouthing Fed Chairman Powell? Was it Trump that stopped the Fed from raising rates? And by the way, they're not going to raise rates anymore. Or was it something else? Was it the markets, the financial markets? And when we say financial markets, we really mean big finance capitalists. You know, they like to say the markets. Well, the markets aren't people. They don't make decisions. It's real people behind the markets that make the decisions. I'm talking about the big investors. They are, quote, the markets. And the rest of the buyers, retail buyers, kind of just follow their lead, you know, with passive investing and indexing and ETFs and all that stuff, right? So it's the big finance capitalists who are the markets, who make the moves in the markets. So did the Fed hike halt? Was that because Trump threatened Fed Chairman Powell? Or was it because, quote, the markets and the big investors behind it got to Powell and made Powell halt? We don't know. You know, we can't prove that because who knows who contacts the Fed chairman and what messages he gets directly and indirectly through politicians and through other members on his open market committee, vice presidents or presidents of the district feds. They're in contact with all these big capitalist bankers all the time. You know, what are the conduits by which the private sector of investors and bankers exert their influence on Fed strategic directions? I'm not saying that the bankers and investors talk to the Fed and make the Fed, you know, month-to-month decisions on rate increase, but no, the main strategic shifts and directions of the Fed is really the product of the influence of bankers and investors, the private sector, on the Fed itself. And we'll talk about that in more detail here because from the very beginning, the Federal Reserve was set up to be controlled by the bankers. In its initial years after 1913, first two decades, the Fed was totally run by the bankers, you know, with no attempt to cover up private bankers running the Federal Reserve. You know, there was no illusion about that. No one talked about central banks being independent. Independent of whom? Of politicians and presidents, or independent of the private bankers? You know, I discussed this in great detail in my book, Central Bankers to the End of Their Ropes, covering the early period of the Fed in particular and showing how it was really run by the bankers. You know, the big bankers controlled The New York Fed, they got their fellow bankers appointed to the governing committee on the Federal Reserve, New York Federal Reserve, and the district feds, the other 11 district feds, their committees were dominated. The vast majority in all their committees were bankers. So the bankers ran their regional feds, and the New York bankers ran the New York Fed, and it was just token influence by Washington. In other words, the Washington board, right? When the crisis hit, of course, in the 1930s and Depression, and the Fed really screwed up, raised interest rates to protect the wealth of bankers and investors' assets, raised interest rates, and in the process of doing so, exacerbated the Depression, and failed to bail out any of the 17,000 banks that crashed, et cetera, the Fed was put aside by the U.S. Treasury and the politicians, and reforms in the Fed were implemented in the mid-1930s. Okay, so, back to the present moment here, did Powell respond to the financial markets, a.k.a. Big finance capitalists and bankers, or did he respond to Trump? And can you really separate the two? I mean, who does Trump really represent? Well, Trump is a big financial speculator himself. You know, he made his, quote, hundreds of millions, maybe billions, and still making it as he's president, his son running the show, by speculating in commercial property markets. That's where he made his money. Apart from bilking it from other lenders. So he's one of these finance capitalists himself. And he surrounded himself with investment bankers, Goldman Sachs, Mnuchin, Cohn, others who are running his show. Okay, so we'll return to this theme, Powell, Fed chair, central bankers. Is there really central bank independence? Independence from whom is the question. You know, academics like to say, oh, the Fed should be independent of politicians because Congress and elected politicians will force the Federal Reserve to engage in expansionary monetary policy in order to boost the economy to get themselves elected. In other words, you can't trust the politicians because they will manipulate monetary policy to their personal career benefits. That's always the argument for central bank independence by academics. But nothing is said by academics about the influence of private banking system and finance on the Fed. You know, what are the channels, the conduits by which the private banking interests and finance capitalists, I don't mean just commercial banks like J.P. Morgan Chase or any of, Wells, et cetera. You know, I mean the big shadow bankers, the investment bankers out there, in the wealthy billionaires. They're the ones who are the new finance capital elite. And you're going to tell me that they have no influence and no contacts on Powell and the Fed? Well, they keep it out of sight. But if you believe that, you're politically naive. Well, all right, so, my thesis is that there's a continuing, behind-the-scenes, significant influence of the private investment class on the Fed policy. And the crash, the 30% collapse of stock prices in November-December last year, and the corresponding collapse in other financial asset markets, including oil, went down 40%, provoked the response and the 180-degree reversal by Powell and the U.S. Federal Reserve, reversal from a schedule of 8 more rate hikes to 1 hike in December, and that was it, and no more rate hikes. And Powell, of course, keeps continuing meeting with Trump here. They just had another meeting last week. It's a fiction. It's a myth that the central bank is independent of outside pressures. And it's also a a myth when the Fed says it doesn't respond to financial markets, it only responds to the real economy. In other words, wage trends and employment trends and GDP and so forth. You know, that's for public consumption. Don't believe for a minute that it doesn't respond to prop up financial markets and asset markets. And of course, Powell's doing that once again. Okay, let's move on from this topic of what's going on between Trump's criticisms of the Fed and Powell, and what's going on behind the Fed doing an abrupt 180-degree reversal in just 2 months. You know, at the end of October, Chairman Powell was still saying, we've got 4 more rate hikes coming in 2019, 3 more, and all of a sudden in 2 months, the real economy goes south, collapses, therefore justifying no more rate hikes? No. What collapsed were the financial asset markets. And once the Fed lowered its rate, it changed its policy and said no more rate increases, guess what happened in January? Well, all the financial markets recovered because they know they're going to continue to get the low, cheap money that they can use to finance their investments. All right. Turning to another financial market here, global oil. Global oil is a commodity, right? It's a physical good, but it's also, as I've been saying, one of the key financial asset markets globally, oil futures, right? Global oil deflation was also underway last year significantly. And as I explained before, that had to do with Trump striking a deal with Saudi Arabia to put sanctions on Iran and slow its export of oil that the Saudis would then jump on and suck up, grab that market share from Iran. But Trump did a double about take here, and under pressure from U.S. businesses with contracts and the Europeans, and he punched all kind of loopholes in those sanctions, and Iranian oil continued to flow. At the same time, the Saudis pumped up their output, thinking that they would pick off the Iranians and sell instead. So what you got was a net increase in oil supply last year, which drove down the price significantly. Also, the factor driving down the price was the continued surge in U.S. oil production, shale oil production. And why is the U.S. continuing to pump up oil and export it, right? U.S. is the biggest exporter and producer of oil in the world today. It's not the Saudis. It's not OPEC. It's not the Russians. You know, they're the other two big ones, the Saudis and the Russians. But the U.S. Is surging ahead of them in terms of oil output and oil exports. Why is the U.S. doing this? Why are U.S. producers, shale oil producers, doing this? Because they borrowed all kind of money in the junk bond market, the drillers, in order to pump out all this oil. And now those short-term high interest rate junk bond debt is coming due. They got to roll it over, so they got to keep pumping even more to pay the principal and interest on that junk debt. Plus, they see an opportunity to take over market share from the other producers worldwide. Okay, so what's new about this? I've said this already. Well, what's new is the Russians and the Saudis came to an agreement here at the end of last year to cut their oil production down by 1.2 million barrels per day for the next 6 months, the first 6 months of 2019, in order to reduce the supply and drive up the price. Okay, so there was this deal between the Russians and OPEC and the Saudis to do that for 6 months. But what happened? Well, the U.S. oil shale guys just kept producing more. So the price of oil went up a little bit to $50, $55 a barrel from the 30s, 40s range, on the announcement and the cutback there by the Saudis and Russians. So there was an adjustment to the price, but that's coming to an end again, right? There's growing reports that the Russia-Saudi deal won't continue beyond June, that it's going to break down, as these deals always have broken down, but largely because the U.S. is not a party to this deal, and the U.S. producers are just pumping oil right and left. And as the Russians and the Saudis reduce their output, the U.S. is grabbing the market share. It's seizing those markets. And that's got the Russians worried and the Saudis worried. You know, why is it that the U.S. all of a sudden in the last year or so is becoming critical of the Saudi government? Not Trump, because he struck deals, but the U.S. Congress and others are finally, pointing a finger at the Saudis because they're not dependent on Saudi oil anymore. And we're going to see more criticism of the Saudi government by the U.S. Well, this Khashoggi deal was one example, but more is coming, right? Well, if we've got this reduction in the output by Russia and the Saudis, what's the U.S. doing? Well, the U.S. shale producers are increasing their output this year to 12 million barrels per day, up from 11 million. And the forecast is for 2020 to continue to increase to 13 million barrels today. So the U.S. producers are pumping out more and more oil, and the Russians and the Saudis are saying, they're taking our markets from us. We can't continue with this cut. We're going to have to return, and that's what's going to happen after the first middle of this year. And you're going to see the price of oil collapse again into the certainly $40 per barrel, maybe even less, right? And when that financial asset market for oil contracts like that, it has a spillover effect to other financial markets, including stock markets. The oil price collapse that's coming may be a precipitating factor in a third leg down of the U.S. stock market. You know, we've had two legs of the market, U.S. stocks, last February 2018. The first contraction, it was it bounced back after that, but we had a 1,000-point day drop in the Dow. And then, of course, in November, December, we had an even greater collapse of U.S. stocks and Chinese and other global stocks, because the stock markets around the world are linked, because the investors, the new global finance capital elite, are playing all around the world, same markets. There's been a recovery because of Powell's halt in interest rate hikes. We see a recovery of the U.S. stock market here in January, February, but that's coming to an end again, too. Powell's, gave it a one boost recovery here, but it's really a short-term bull market surge in what's a long-term now stock bear market globally and in the U.S. Okay, so let's watch what happens with Russia, Saudi, and U.S. producers. It's important not only for the price of oil, but for the entire financial market stability worldwide. All right, let's turn to another financial topic here. We sort of addressed the Trump-Powell affair and global oil affair. Let's look at U.S. government debt. As you know, I've been talking about this, the federal government debt, roughly $21 trillion, and I've predicted on this show and in my writings on my blog, jackrasmus.com, that the U.S. debt, government debt, federal government debt, is going to rise by $12 trillion. You know, at $21 trillion now, by the end of the next decade, by 2027, it's going to be $33 trillion. I've been saying that. Okay? And the Congressional Budget Office predicts that by the end of the decade, the U.S. is going to be paying $900 billion a year just on interest on that debt. $900 billion, almost $1 trillion a year. Well, what have been the drivers of that coming surge in the U.S. Federal debt? State and local government debt's on top of all that, you know. Well, what are the drivers? Well, I've been saying it's the Trump tax cuts. You know, that's levied a huge amount on top of already rising debt in the U.S. because of tax cuts for 15 years and defense spending rises for 15 years since 2001. You know, that's what drove the U.S. debt from $5 trillion in 2000 to $15 trillion, $16 trillion by the end of Obama's term, right? It's the $10 to $15 trillion of tax cuts that occurred, and the $3 to $4 trillion in war spending that occurred, and of course the price gouging by the big pharma and medical industry that causes government debt and expenditures to rise for prescription drugs, Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth, you know, and of course rising Homeland Security costs that kick in 2001, $50-60 billion a year. All of that is behind the surge in the U.S. federal debt from $5 trillion to $15-16 trillion by 2016. Okay, but it's continued to rise, you know, significantly under Trump. Well, what are the drivers under Trump? The big thing is the tax cuts, which I've said time and again, are really tax cuts to the rich and their corporations of between $4 and $5 trillion over the decade. And also Trump pumping up defense spending by at least $100 billion a year and continuing to do so. Right? And I predict as well there will be a recession, and when there's a recession, government tax revenues fall. And therefore the deficit rises and the debt rises. So we got three drivers of my predicted $12 trillion, the tax cuts, most of which go to corporations and wealthy individuals, the defense hikes, and the coming recession. Okay. Now, what I want to talk about here, I've been talking about that you know, in previous shows, but what I want to add on top of that is there's now another factor involved in the debt. Well, actually, it's been there, but now it's being reported here. And that is foreign buyers of U.S. Treasury bonds, i.e. the debt, has been sliding, in other words, declining rather fast, if you look at it. And what that means, if foreigners are buying less and less U.S. Treasury bonds, that means that the Fed and the U.S. Treasury have to sell more bonds to U.S. investors and households. Okay? How do you get people to buy more bonds? You have to raise the interest rate on those bonds. Oh, but wait a minute. Powell stopped raising interest rates, didn't he? Doesn't look like he's going to raise them anymore. Whoa, that's an issue here. How is it with the debt increasing by $12 trillion and foreigners buying less and less of it, meaning more domestic buyers have to occur, we're not raising interest rates? Well, we're not raising interest rates because it's slowing down the real economy. So there's a big contradiction here from monetary policy and the central bank. It must raise rates in order to sell more bonds to cover rising debt. But by raising rates, it causes financial markets to collapse. So what's it going to do? Cover the deficit in the debt that's ballooning? And cause more slowdown in financial asset markets and the real economy, by the way, really impacts auto sales, you know, which have come to a halt in the U.S., and housing, ditto. Is it really going to raise rates to finance the debt, or is it going to not raise rates to subsidize financial markets, and they are therefore not cover the debt? That's a big contradiction, you see. That's one of the major weaknesses in the U.S. economy going forward that people often don't see. You know, all this focus on phony trade wars and everything. This is far bigger, far more important. And in fact, there is an organization called the Treasury Bond Advisory Committee, the TBAC, that's advisory to the U.S. Treasury. And they just released a letter, a private letter that's become public, to Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. The TBAC sent this letter just in recent weeks, it's been reported, warning that we're going to have a $12 trillion additional debt to finance. Well, isn't that interesting? They agree to my number, $12 trillion. Okay, I won't argue with that. Now, they also say in this letter that buyers' own foreign ownership of U.S. debt is going to continue to decline. Well, what is that ownership today compared to, let's say, a decade before? Well, a decade ago, it was 45%. 45% of the U.S. federal government debt was owned by foreign buyers, foreign ownership. You know, private buyers, private banks and companies, a lot of foreign central banks. And, of course, you know, one of the big buyers of the central bank buyers is the People's Bank of China. You know, China holds, did hold $1.25 trillion in U.S. securities, and of course the Japanese $1 trillion as well, and then you know, the OPEC oil producing petro economies, hundreds of billions in Europe, hundreds of billions, so they're all holding all these dollars, you see, but they're buying less and less of these dollars, dollars, T-bonds, treasuries, right? Ownership, foreign ownership of U.S. treasuries and assets, government assets, are now down to 36%, from 45 to 36%. It's interesting that China is particularly selling off these securities, even though it says it's not its policy, right? Well, how much? Well, as I said, in 2016, China held $1.25 trillion. In 2018, it held $1.12 trillion. So in other words, in 2 years, it sold off, what? How much? Well, about $120 billion? $130 billion? Well, just in the 6 months, it's reported. 6 months between May and November 2018, it sold $600 billion. Of U.S. Treasury, $600 billion in about 6 months. That's significant, $600 billion. And, you know, if the U.S. continues to pick a trade fight with the Europeans and the Japanese, how much of their holdings will they sell off? And, of course, it appears the U.S. picking fights with the Saudis. How much will they sell off? And the Saudis are aligning themselves closer with Russia. On a number of issues here, how much will they sell off? Well, in other words, bottom line, we got a problem. They got a problem. Trump has a problem. U.S. government has a problem. U.S. economy has a problem with foreigners reducing their holdings of U.S. treasuries significantly. China taking the lead in that. Well, that's occurring and will likely continue to occur as the need to sell more bonds accelerates. So it's not just the fact that we got $12 trillion more in U.S. debt coming. It's that foreigners were buying less and less of it, which means somehow the Treasury has to sell more and more of it, even faster than recently, to U.S. investors. Now, as I said before, the only way you can get U.S. investors to buy more Treasury bonds is to raise the interest on it, the yield. To raise that, you got to raise interest rates. Jerome Powell? Oh, but wait a minute. Jerome does that. Trump don't like it. You know, and more importantly, the financial markets and financial investors don't like it because it trips the stock markets into a big correction. The stock market should have corrected a long time ago, but the reason that they haven't is because of all the subsidization going on of stocks and financial assets in this country. The Fed, with its super low interest rates, pumping all the free money. And then when the Fed reversed this, it was the Trump tax cuts subsidizing and corporations passing the big profits and the big cash holdings and cash hoards, passing it on to their shareholders. We're going to talk about that. You know, we're going to talk about stock buybacks and dividend payouts. There's a connection here, isn't there, between Fed policy, interference with Fed policy, on the one hand, right? The U.S. debt and the increasing difficulty of financing the U.S. debt. Foreigners reducing their holdings of U.S. debt. And the stock buybacks and dividend payouts that have boosted the stock market artificially well beyond its normal cycle. So the Fed and Trump and the tax cuts, right, and the buybacks and dividends are artificially keeping the economy and the markets going. How long can that last? You know, reportedly in the Financial Times here today, the big U.S. hedge funds, quote, privately concluded that in 5 years' time, the U.S. Treasury will need to sell bonds equivalent to 25% of the U.S. GDP, up now from 15%. Only during World War II and the 2008 crash was this level of debt and financing of this level of debt an issue. Well, if there was an issue back in 2008, we haven't improved anything. We haven't corrected anything, have we? Okay, let's move on to this topic of stock buybacks and dividend payouts, connected to the whole question of the tax cuts and so forth, and Fed policy, monetary fiscal policy, in other words, subsidizing big corporations, big investors, and their big shareholders. Now, both monetary and fiscal policy are subsidizing these people artificially and keeping the whole boom going rather than allowing it to correct, you know, and shake out all the dead wood, you know, all the zombie corpse and so forth that shouldn't be around. The Fed and the government, Trump tax cuts, are keeping these alive. You know, it's like a forest fire. You know, a big forest fire, if you don't clear out, periodically clear out all the dead wood, when the forest fire occurs, it's more ferocious than otherwise it would have been if you had allowed the smaller fires to occur, right, to clear out all the dead wood. You know, allowing contractions would clear out of the economy, to use the metaphor, would clear out all the dead wood. But the dead wood is accumulating. All the zombie corporations are accumulating out there. Accumulating because both the Fed and the government are subsidizing it and not allowing the normal capitalist process to work to clean out the dead wood. You see, capitalists have always realized that in the boom period, a lot of companies that shouldn't continue are allowed to continue. But then when you have recessions and financial contractions, you know, it wipes out that deadwood, and the healthy corporations buy up the assets that are worth saving from that deadwood, and the rest are allowed to, you know, to disappear. Well, they're not allowing that anymore. And they're propping up and subsidizing through monetary fiscal policy. That's what's been going on since 2000, especially since 2009. Big problem. Well, what's the scope and magnitude of the stock buybacks and dividend payouts? Because it's those buybacks and payouts to investors that those investors then turn around and reinvest to keep the stock and other financial markets booming. And of course, all that, and we'll talk about the magnitude of the buybacks, all of that excess cash goes back into the markets and boosts the price and the wealth, on paper at least, of those same investors. Or if they're CEOs, you know, and they get a big chunk of the dividends and the stock buybacks through the stock awards, right? You know, CEOs enrich themselves significantly with stock buybacks, personally. Okay, so what is the dimension of these stock buybacks? And what, if anything, is being done about it? All right, here's some figures. And this is all official data, either from the business press or from government research or other sources, right? Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, right? J.P. Morgan, etc. All right, here's some dimensions. Little historical. In 2009, the combined stock buybacks and dividend payouts by corporations to the shareholders was about $500 billion. Yeah, $500 billion during the collapse. They're still pumping money to their shareholders and investors. That rose steadily from 2011 on. 2011 and 12, the combined buybacks and dividends were about $750 billion, rising to $800 billion, $950 billion in 14, about $1 trillion in 2015, and $1 trillion in 2016. Okay, so almost $1 trillion a year for 6 years. Made possible, you know, by corporate profits rising, one sorts, but also by the low interest rates, which allowed companies, you know, like Apple, to issue corporate bonds and use that bond revenue to buy back their stock while they were sitting on a cash hoard, Apple, of $250 billion, issuing corporate bonds, using it to buy back stock and pay dividends, and hoarding their cash. Okay, so almost $1 trillion a year on average. Certainly around $800 to $900 billion over the 6 years from 2011 to 2016. This is wealth being distributed in income form to the shareholders. And of course, you know, it's only the top 5% wealthiest households that own like 85-90% of all the stock in this country. And that's even concentrated in the top 1% and concentrated further in the top 0.1%. Okay, so almost $1 trillion on average from 2011-16 every year. Well, then Trump comes in 2017, and what do we get? We get $770 billion in stock buybacks and another $420 billion in dividend payouts. So we get $1.1 to $1.2 trillion. In other words, instead of $900 billion under Trump, it jumps by like $300 billion in 2017. $1.2 trillion in 2017. Then come the Trump tax cuts at the end of 2017. And then the really big surge comes, and we go from 1.1 trillion to 1.4 trillion in 2018 in combined stock buybacks and dividend payouts. You know, about $450 billion in dividend payouts and about $940 billion or so in stock buybacks. In the first half of the year, $536 billion in stock buybacks. Third quarter, $204 billion. The data, I don't think, is in for fourth quarter. But if we assume a fourth quarter, the same as third quarter, about $200 billion, we're getting somewhere between $940 to $950 billion in stock buybacks alone, a 56% increase over 2007, according to the Financial Times. And another $1.4 trillion, which I predicted a year ago, when I was saying about 1.3. Well, it's even more than that. It's 1.4 this year in stock buybacks. Now, hold your seat. That's only for the Fortune 500 companies, the 500 biggest companies. $1.4 trillion distributed to shareholders just for the Fortune 500. How much are all the other corporations distributing in buybacks and dividend payouts? I don't have the figures for that. But you can bet that that $1.4 trillion for the Fortune 500 is really well over $2 trillion. Well over $2 trillion for the rest. When you include the rest. And that's probably low. That's probably low. Now, you talk about income inequality in this country, right? And economists and progressives focus on wage stagnation and minimum wage, and all that's true. That's hardly rising, in many cases lowering. And I've talked about how the wage numbers are really misrepresented of the true wage increases in this country. And I'll have another show on that. so wages are roughly stagnant at best. And at the same time, capital incomes in the form of stock buybacks and capital gains and dividends and interest and so forth, are going through the roof. Well, the financial asset markets are the real source of the income inequality accelerating in this country. And yes, it's okay to talk about what are we going to do to raise wages, minimum wages and so forth. But if you really want to do something about inequality, you better impose some major financial transaction taxes. That's the only way. And boy, is that fat city, over $2 trillion sitting out there just in buybacks and dividends, not taxed? Well, the drivers, of course, from 2011 to 2016 have been corporate profits subsidized by the Fed and other sources, right? Low interest rates, which allowed corporations to sell bonds cheaply and raise cash that way, and then the Trump tax cuts after 2017. Now, finally, the politicians have discovered this, Democrat Senator Schumer and Sanders have recently come out here this past week with proposals for legislation to require corporations to increase their wages and benefits as a condition of issuing stock buybacks. And they also called on the Securities Exchange Commission to investigate how CEOs are benefiting personally from increasing these buybacks. All right, that's good. It's good to raise the issue, but your little Johnny come lately, Schumer and Sanders, to this issue. It's been going on, a $1 trillion scam, for a long time, and now they discover it, right? Well, this is part of their 2020 campaign, Democratic campaign. They're raising this issue, proposing legislation in the House in particular. They know it won't go anywhere. I mean, the Republicans aren't going to shoot their campaign contributions cash cow, corporations and the wealthy investors. No, they're not going to do that. So, you know, it'll never get through the Senate. You might have something pass the House, but it'll never get through the Senate. And if it got through the Senate, Trump would veto it for sure. So, you know, it's really a campaign marketing thing for the Democrats. I don't fault them for raising it, finally. But to say that corporations that pay more than $15 an hour got to raise their wages, I mean, excuse me, raise wages and or benefits as a precondition, look, you know, I mean, these corporations aren't going to raise their wages. I mean, look at the richest corporation in the U.S. What is that? Amazon. I believe Amazon now surpasses Apple, okay? News coming out all the time how Jeff Bezos is chiseling his workers, you know, hardly paying them anything, not giving any raises, et cetera. And, of course, we know in the case of Apple, you know, what about its 100,000 workers offshore working for Foxconn in China and the wages they get per hour? Pittance. No, they're not going to raise wages, you know. But, you know, I don't fault Schumer and Sanders for raising, finally, this issue. You know, stock buybacks, $1 trillion-plus stock buybacks every year and rising under Trump, right? For example, the tech companies, Apple, Google, Cisco, Microsoft, Oracle, in the first 9 months of 2018, bought back $115 billion in its stock. Now, you know, apologists for capitalism and corporations will argue that, oh, you know, giving them more cash, giving corporations more cash and distributing it to shareholders will result in more real investment occurring. And that will mean more jobs, you know, and real investment, meaning investing in plants and equipment and infrastructure and so forth, right? Construction, et cetera. That's real investment. We call that real asset investment, or what in GDP calls net capital expenditures. All right, $115 billion in stock buybacks, but they only spent $42 billion in investment, $42 billion. And we don't know how that's really distributed, whether it's job producing or whatever, or where the investment actually occurred, the $42 billion, you know, how much of it offshore, how much of it in the U.S. I suspect that, you know, it's probably a 10-to-1 ratio, $115 billion in buybacks and maybe $10 billion in real investment occurring in the United States, 10-to-1. Another interesting comparison is McDonald's Corporation, right? Massive buybacks in the last few years. Equivalent, if McDonald's, instead of buying back its stock, took that amount of money that it used to buy back its stock and gave it to its 1.9 million employees, it would mean a $4,000 a year wage increase every year for the last 3 years for its 1.9 million employees. It would raise their wages $4,000 a year. Almost 2 million people would get a $4,000 a year every year increase, just equivalent to McDonald's stock buybacks. You know, you can do these comparisons over and over for all the cases. Corporations, you know, the big tech companies, the big banks, the big pharma and insurers, they are the big buybackers in the Fortune 500. Okay. And as I've said, you know, one of the fundamental themes in my book, Systemic Fragility and Global Economy, chapter 11 and 12, talks about how we have a shift from real investment to financial asset markets and investment, and how it's the shadow bankers that are driving this shift in the driver's seat here. And, you know, the money's flowing out into these liquid financial asset markets, not just stock markets, but other kind of markets worldwide, buying all these new securities that are being created in their global financial casino. And it's crowding out. It's diverting. My thesis was it's diverting the direction of a real investment that will create jobs. That's why jobs are stagnating. One reason, job creation. And yes, they are stagnating. We'll talk about that next week. All this hoopla by Trump of millions of jobs being created. I think, well, just to give you one counter argument in that regard on the jobs, as I've said before, you know, it's not the real data. It's a statistic based on manipulated real data. And one of the manipulations has to do with assumptions associated with new business development 9 months previous to the job report. That's one thing. All right. The other thing is about job. I think these job numbers are overinflated because they show job creation, not employment created. They call it employment, but it's really jobs. And I believe more and more people are working second, even third jobs. So it looks like more jobs are being created, but the number of people working have not been increasing anywhere near as fast as the jobs have been increasing. You know, they call it employment, but it's really a job number. And if you have a accelerating part-time work, you know, in temp work, which is really the case here, what you've got is the appearance of more jobs, even though the employment itself is not rising as fast. Okay, so that's another thing, you know, and we'll talk about that and the phony assumptions that go into all the predictions about wages and hourly earnings increase. But not today. We'll come back to that because that deserves an entire show. Okay, so, you know, just to recap before some final comments here, global oil prices will go down, dragging down other financial markets as the U.S. shale producers continue to boost production and as the Saudis and Russians abandon their agreement after June to reduce production costs, right? They're just playing into the hands of the U.S., and the U.S. is sitting back, and oil producers and, you know, gleefully watching the whole thing go on between Russia and the Saudis. And then we talked about this really important topic of U.S. government debt going up $12 trillion, and how now there's a question whether it will be financed and whether it might even be more than $12 trillion if foreigners stop buying the debt or slow their purchases of U.S. treasuries, which it appears is happening and will continue to happen if U.S. interest rates don't rise. And if U.S. rates don't rise, how are we going to elicit more U.S. purchasers of treasuries? But if they do raise interest rates, the contradiction is to slow the real economy and precipitate a crash for the third crash of the stock and bond markets. Okay, that's the big contradiction, you see. And Trump exacerbated it with his tax cuts, just as the Federal Reserve exacerbated it with its chronically low six-year-long interest rates and QE programs. And now the two worst precipitators of the debt crisis, Powell and Trump, are meeting, right? And the likely outcome is they'll continue the low interest rates, which means the deficit and debt isn't going to be financed. It's going to get worse. All right. And then we talked about how the stock buybacks and dividend binge is behind us as well, because a lot of the buybacks and dividend payouts are enabled by the Trump tax cuts. You know, corporate income tax revenues down $300 billion this year, right? Well, That translates right into deficit and debt. And then we talked about Schumer and Sanders' recent announcement of doing something. You know, nothing will actually happen, but at least they're acknowledging the scope and magnitude of the problem. They're not linking it enough to income inequality. You know, the Democrats are saying they're going to do something about income inequality. Well, if you really want to do something about it, tax all these financial transactions and then use the money to create a U.S. Government corporate investment corporation to spend directly, you know, on infrastructure. If the private sector won't do it, let the government do it. Right? Where are you going to get the money? Financial transaction tax. Where, you know, it won't take much, and you'll get hundreds of billions of dollars for that by, you know, going after this the big handouts for investors and corporations. You know, the $1.4 trillion a year now. Right? Final comment on China-U.S. trade. We've been talking about that. Both Mnuchin and Lighthizer, the heads of the two main factions in the U.S. trade negotiations, are off to Beijing here, and negotiations are continuing. Trump says, oh, it doesn't look like there'll be a deal by the deadline date. They'll extend the deadline date. You know, as I said, there will be a deal, but it won't be by March 1st. It will be later, but there will be a deal. Okay. Okay. So that's the major round robin of the main topics this week here. The Fed and Trump meeting, global oil, the debt, the Treasury Bond Advisory Committee's letter to Mnuchin, and the Schumer-Sanders initiative on stock buybacks and dividend payouts. Okay, next week, see you again. Screaming now.